On June 26, leaders from the world's wealthiest eight countries will be gathering in Alberta to plan the economic future for the rest of the world's 6 billion people. And communities across Canada are gearing up, organizing teach-ins, marches, direct actions, all to denounce the hypocrisy of a few elite waging economic warfare on the rest of the world. And so on the line with us today is Sarah Lamble from the Peterborough Coalition Against Poverty, as well as the Global Action Group there in Peterborough. And also on the line with us is Chris Arsenault, who most recently was involved in activities with the Atlantic G7 Welcoming Committee. And Chris, I wonder if we can start with you, because recently there was a minister's meeting in Halifax that turned out to be a police riot in the streets there. So I wonder if you can just give our listeners an overview of what happened this past weekend in Halifax.
Well, I'd be more than happy to. On the first day of action, it was Friday, and we began at the Halifax Commons, kind of a public space. There was a really awesome reggae band, and we had a bunch of different speakers from a whole wide variety of communities, the Africville Genealogy Society, a couple of labor groups, anti-war activists. So really to put the G7, G8 in perspective in terms of community and global issues. So from the Commons, we marched through the downtown. We stopped by City Hall where they were dining and chanted and made some noise and banged their drums there. And then we outmaneuvered the police to get to Halifax's main street, which is Spring Garden Road. And there a bunch of local youths went through the mall and tried to reclaim that as public space, as a space for protest, and that was very positive. And then the day kind of ended at the Commons. So Friday was basically a day of creative and festive resistance. We really outmaneuvered the cops on Friday. They'd try to block off a road, and we'd simply take the sidewalk and then go back on the road, or many things like that. But they felt outmaneuvered. And when Saturday rolled around, which was to be the day of more kind of direct action, we knew the police were on the defensive and then ready to kind of strike back. And that's really exactly what happened, which you said. So Saturday we began again with speakers, and then went directly down to the World Trade and Convention Center, which is where the rich and powerful would be meeting and having their final press conference. So there was a doubled line of barricades between us and a line of police, and thus between the delegates and us. So as the line of barricades was fundamentally undemocratic, activists moved it to stand face to face with the police. After that, details depends who you talk to as to what happened. We feel with as the Atlantic G7 Welcoming Committee that there was a provocateur in the crowd who shot a slingshot over the police's head. The reason why we think he was a provocateur is because A, nobody knew him, B, he wouldn't justify his actions, and C, he didn't shoot the projectile actually at the police, he shot it over them, which would lead you to believe that he was probably one of their buddies who wanted to make some noise but didn't want to actually hurt anybody. So he did that, and then corporate media were trying to film people who didn't want to be filmed, and there was a brief scuttle. And those two instances, after those two things happened, neither of which were the fault of really any of us, the police unleashed a brutal wave of tear gas. Activists were hit in the chest directly with tear gas canisters, and the crowd was very unprepared for this. Earlier that day, my friend had asked if she should bring her gas mask, and I was like, oh, no, this is Halifax. It's not going to happen here. And then, of course, it did. So our street medics were quite well prepared. We went back at them. We ate a bit of food and held our ground at the barricade and continued to voice our opposition there. So during that point, I had a megaphone most of the time and was kind of directing people and giving kind of rallying cries and leading chants, and that proved to be my personal, the reason why I was picked off later on. But from that major intersection, we marched around more later. We reclaimed Citadel Hill, which is the main. It was an old fortress in Halifax in the early days, and we reclaimed that for the people and marched around that, and then went back through downtown, and by about 5 o'clock, the police were getting really angry, really aggressive. They stole a banner and arrested one of the people carrying it, and then from there, we wanted to disperse, and it really didn't seem like it would be that easy. We kept walking down towards the waterfront, and every street was blocked off by lines of police, and there was just nowhere to go. So then the police rushed us, and things got insane. People started running and became very disorganized. And I ran and hid by some with a few friends by some condominiums because I knew I was being watched. And at that point, an undercover Arsenault grabbed me and said, "Mr. Arsenault, you're under arrest." Didn't read my rights, of course, never alluded to any charges, and tackled me. And at that point, a group of other activists, seeing this travesty, grabbed him and tried to puppy pile me, or tried to stop him from covering me or taking me down. And at that point, in a total breach of police procedure or any kind of legitimate human rights, a number of police officers stepped in and pulled his gun on us. And this wasn't some protest stun gun. This was a real good old-fashioned GAT. And at that point, I told people to get off of me, and I was carted away on no charges. So that's kind of how the protests went themselves. And I had some fun times at a couple different jails after that.
Well, Chris, help us backtrack for a moment. This is events that happened over the weekend of the 14th and 15th, and the G8 finance ministers were meeting there in Halifax. What was on their agenda, and how and why did the community there, the G7 Welcoming Committee, organize to greet these folks?
Well, firstly, this actually isn't the G8. It was the G7. Russia takes part in terms of military matters, in terms of terrorism matters, these sorts of things. But Russia was actually not an equal participant at the table of this meeting. So the people who were in there were the leaders of the G7 countries, and somebody to represent Russia, but who wasn't actually at the table. The EU representative, which was Spain, and then the governors of all the central banks, so Alan Greenspan, David Dodge, all those guys, and also representatives from the IMF and World Bank. So it was pretty much the star-studded cast of the cronies of backward global capitalism. What they were talking about is the so-called war on terrorism, which is obviously a war on dissent, and Africa, African development, and basically the global economy was their agenda. Now, our agenda wasn't really so radically different from that, which is quite funny. You see, we dealt with Africa, too. And as I mentioned, one of the speakers on Friday was a woman from the Africville Genealogy Society. And Africville was a very vibrant black community in Nova Scotia, which was bulldozed and destroyed by the government in the 1960s to build a key transportation route. And the people of Africville have still not been adequately compensated, and they've basically been moved into a ghetto situation in Halifax. So basically what our focus was is that, I mean, these people can't get things right for Africans in their own communities, in their own country. So what right did they have to then go to Africa and impose a backward economic doctrine upon them? So that was kind of making the links between global and local. There are plenty of other reasons why Maritimers are pissed off about this whole new global economic order. Nova Scotia enjoys the lowest minimum wage and the highest university tuition in Canada. And this has, although this may sound like a classic lefty gripe, this has very strong roots in the corporate globalization enforced by the G7. And the reason for this is that if you look at the minimum wage, the G7, and for their kind of global economy to work, they need an army of unemployed or underemployed workers who will work in the service sector for the new corporate economy. These are your Walmarts, your McDonald's, your Starbucks, these sorts of things. And they need to have people who are willing to work in these places and willing to work several jobs in these places. And that's why they have to keep the minimum wage low. Because that way they can pay people the least amount they want. There'll be plenty of unemployed workers, and they can get away with it. And if somebody, say, oh, I don't know, tries to organize a union in one of these places, they can be fired. And because the minimum wage is low, and because there's not any better jobs, and because there's a surplus of the unemployed, people will go and take that job. As for the university tuition, it comes to kind of a moral thing as much as an economic one. I mean, the new mode for university is that the university is a business. It's a training ground so people can be in business, be in commerce, be in computer science, these sorts of things. It's not an institution of higher learning, of social critique, of understanding. It's a business like every other function in our society. And this goes right along with the G7 agenda, because now that business is there to make a profit. And if you happen to be maybe a marginalized student, a student who doesn't have a lot of money, whatever, you can go. And there was, at the university I intend to go to, Dalhousie, there was just an 8% tuition hike there. So, I mean, you've got a very marginalized province and a very marginalized area here in Nova Scotia. I mean, there's also other issues. The Sydney tar ponds, which are basically one of the worst environmental hazards in North America. The government refuses to clean it up. It's been left by heavy industry, and the people there in a working-class community suffer. Furthermore, our fishery has been basically destroyed by corporate fishers and their huge trawlers, and now native people who have a legitimate and constitutional right to fish have had their rights robbed by Clearwater and other multinationals and their puppet state. So globalization has really hit home hard here in the Maritimes, and the people in our community worked very hard to mobilize against this, mostly for ourselves, but also for the 1.2 billion people who live almost $1 a day, our comrades in the global south. So people were angry, and they have a very, very good right to be angry around here.
Well, Chris, what was the response of the community there in Halifax, as well as the corporate media, to these issues that you raised in the streets over the weekend?
Well, the corporate media's response has been really terrible. I mean, Global News has their poll saying 60% of people thought the protesters were out of line. And, of course, I mean, what the corporate media showed was not the issues, was not the drop in purchasing power of low-wage workers or the destruction of our environment. No, no. What the corporate media, as always, showed was the one kid with the slingshot. Somebody throwing a stick at a cop, these sorts of things. So, I mean, no, the corporate media was absolutely dastardly, and they've had their backwards polls. This is saying that everybody denounced the protesters. I was actually on the country music station yesterday for kind of an interview like this, and everybody who called, except for one guy who used to be in the police force, was supportive of protesters. So, it's really hard to gauge community response from the mainstream media. They've really gone to war with us on the violence side notion. But I'd say the response of the community has been positive. I was buying newspapers the other day in a convenience store, and the woman who worked there was like, oh, another police riot, eh? And everybody I've talked to on the streets on a personal level has supported our actions. So, I mean, it's really hard to say. I mean, the way the National Post and Asper's group words their polls makes it really hard to say. So, I don't know, but I'd say it was a very successful action. It was a very important step for the people of Halifax, and us in the community are very happy with our response and, of course, sickened by the systematic violence of our police force.
Well, let's bring Sarah into the conversation. Sarah, you're organizing there in Peterborough for some upcoming solidarity actions that are happening around the G8 summit, which is coming up very soon on June 26th and 27th in Kananaskis, Alberta. What's being planned in Peterborough, and are people looking to actions like what happened in Halifax to kind of guide their mobilization in the streets there?
Well, we're trying a slightly different focus. We're trying to, because the sort of mobilizations that are happening in Ottawa in solidarity with the protest in Kananaskis, we thought that sort of like large-scale mobilization and marching and sort of like confrontation stuff, we wanted to like send people to Ottawa, but we also wanted to have a local event that was focused on one of the more sort of key issues that's facing the city of Peterborough right now, which is our housing crisis. So we decided that there aren't enough connections in the community being made between the sort of policies of the G8 and how they are connected to the local housing crisis. And not a lot of people are aware of this, but recently the nonprofit housing association identified Peterborough as having the most serious affordable housing crisis in the province. And as such, the city has been dubbed the homeless capital of Ontario. And so we see that very daily on the streets. The shelters are overflowing. Hundreds of families are severely underhoused, living in one-bedroom apartments or two or three families sharing one house. There's thousands of people on waiting lists for affordable housing, and the waiting period tends to be 8 to 10 years. And the sort of rate of homelessness is increasing at a very fast rate. So, and of course, the local and provincial and federal governments have refused to take action on this. And we feel that these sort of issues are directly related to the policies of the G7 and the G8, who have sort of set the tone of, no more government spending on things like social housing. That should be left to the forces of the free market. And, of course, as we have seen over the past 10 or 20 years, the market cannot be relied upon to provide affordable housing to those who need it. So what we are trying to do, and this is primarily coming out of the Peterborough Coalition Against Poverty in sort of connection with the Ontario Common Front Against the Tories, and also part of the Globalization Action Group out of OPERG in Peterborough, we've sort of launched a housing campaign. And there's a group of us who have formed the Mad Housers. And we're basically a group of anti-poverty activists who are mad about the state of housing in Peterborough and are committed to direct action to change the situation. And we sort of modeled ourselves out of a group by the same name that came out of Atlanta, Georgia. And what they did was basically build temporary shelters. They're sort of 1 to 2 person very small huts that have enough space basically for a loft sleeping area and then a small sort of cooking area, and it can be hooked up to electricity and water. And basically, they build these shelters and they deposit them in locations, sort of discrete locations where they can be squatted, or public locations where sometimes they're sort of adopted by, like, churches on church property or in various places. And people who are homeless or underhoused can sort of stay in these shelters. So we've decided to take on a similar project here. And we recognize that this is obviously temporary shelter, and this is not a solution to the housing crisis. So what we're trying to do is build these sort of shelters, but with it we're launching a series of demands. And we have demands to the city of Peterborough, demands to the province, the provincial government, and to the federal government to address sort of housing issues. So on Sunday, this upcoming Sunday, we sort of planned the launching of our campaign. And we're hoping that sort of activists who are going to the Ottawa events on Wednesday and Thursday will kind of stop in on Peterborough on their way up for the Sunday action before. So we'll basically be unveiling our first madhouse, and we will be squatting it basically in a location for 3 days with our demands, and then it'll be deposited in another location for housing for someone in the city of Peterborough. And we hope to continue to do this. Part of our, in our demands, we've stated that we will continue to build these sort of temporary shelters and push our demands until everybody in the city of Peterborough has safe, affordable housing.
Now, Sarah, has it been much of a challenge to talk about these local issues in terms of their relationships to corporate globalization, to entities like the G8 and the G7?
Yeah, it definitely has been a challenge. I think a lot of people, when you sort of talk about anti-globalization politics or anti-corporate globalization, people think about the large organizations but sort of disconnected from the kind of local everyday struggles. And I think there's more of a kind of trend to make the connection between the sort of local and the global, but a lot of people will ask, I don't see the connection between housing and the G8. You know, the G8 is talking about debt in Africa, or the G8 is talking about trade policies. And so it is a sort of bit of a struggle sometimes to, like, make the connections and have it so that people can understand how these organizations, their policies, trickle down sort of to the local level. And so that's one of the reasons why I'm really excited that we're having this sort of housing-focused action as part of the anti-G8 events, because I think it will help to make those connections and help people sort of focus on how the local and the global are connected and why we need to sort of integrate those struggles.
Chris, what about in Halifax? Did you find it a challenge there to talk with people in the streets about the relationship between local Halifax issues and larger issues of corporate globalization?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, again, we're really, I mean, what I think our movement has to fundamentally realize is that we can't play on their terms anymore. I mean, personally, I don't want to rip any activists, but I think it's ridiculous that Toronto Mob Club is sending a plane to Kananaskis at an expense of over $600 per person. So I think, A, we have to make these connections, but it is very, very difficult. So, I mean, on this country music radio interview yesterday, some guy called in and said, well, I'm angry that the tax on cigarettes has gone up, and I'm angry about the city coupons. What can you guys do for me? And that's pretty much where it stands. So for people in the know, it's easy. For people who are kind of political, like for community-based activists, like for refugee activists or for Palestinian activists or for black activists who are already activists, they can usually understand the connections. But for people who are just off the street, it's quite a big jump to say, here's the problem with our community, here's this thing, so get active about it. And that's been really difficult. We've done a good job. I mean, we've put up over 2,000 posters and had a large teach-in to educate people about these things. But to say that it's easier that everybody just gets it would be pretty naive and silly. It's a very difficult struggle. It takes a lot of courage and a lot of really good intuition and a lot of just the ability to make the links really quickly, just like that. Like when somebody says, "Well, how does this affect this?" To be able to give them a very clear path of how that works takes a lot of skill. And we're trying to kind of educate our organizers to be able to do that. But some people are getting it, but it's going to take a lot of time.
Well, let's expand upon that, what can you do for me? Sarah, in Peterborough, one of the criticisms of the anti-corporate globalization movement is that it has no vision or that it has no real alternatives. How would you come back to such an argument or retort such an argument?
Well, again, I would probably go back to the local. I think one of the sort of reasons why the kind of, if we can talk about the anti-globalization movement, doesn't have a particular blueprint of what things are supposed to look like is because I think that blueprint would be very dangerous. I think local communities need to decide what their needs are, and they need to connect with other communities so that they can be in solidarity with each other. But I think every sort of community has unique needs, and we need to be sort of forging those plans on a local level with sort of the global in mind. So here in Peterborough, housing is a key issue. And there has been, I mean, one of the reasons why I wanted to get involved with this action is because the sort of two of the groups that I'm involved in, the Peterborough Coalition Against Poverty versus the Globalization Action Group, are made up of very different sort of groups of people. The Globalization Action Group is very much sort of a Trent student sort of based group. It's largely white, middle class, whereas the Peterborough Coalition Against Poverty is primarily made up of poor and working people. And so, and often the kind of struggles that the two are working on are very connected, and yet the two groups haven't always worked together a lot in the past, or they haven't, the kind of issues that they've involved in have been parallel but not linked. So trying to link those sort of issues and link those groups of people together is a really key thing, at least in my mind, for us sort of building alternatives. So one of those things about building alternatives is we think that everybody in Peterborough should have safe, affordable housing. So we want to take particular steps, and we've sort of launched specific demands at all three levels of government to get those needs met for people. So I think, I mean, and of course there's we need to connect with all sorts of other issues so that we can sort of be building alternative societies as we go. But I think it can be really dangerous to have a sort of plan in mind, because whose plan is that going to be? And like, I think it's an ongoing process and an ongoing struggle that we sort of have visions of what justice might look like and, you know, what equality might be, but it's sort of always ongoing and it's always being negotiated and rethought, and we have to think of who is making those decisions about what will be defined and what needs will be sort of set as the priority. So I think those are kind of things to keep in mind when we're sort of planning around our actions and trying to make connections about what we want the future to look like.
Well, Chris, in Halifax, what's coming up there in light of the police response to the G7 finance ministers meeting and the protest that was in the streets during that?
Well, on a large scale, we're pushing for an inquiry right now. One of our local MLAs, Howard Epstein, is pushing very hard for an inquiry into the police tactics. Obviously, those in the Conservative government and others are pushing hard against that, but we're trying for a formal inquiry. We're having a legal meeting on Friday, actually, where a prominent black activist lawyer, Rocky Jones, has agreed to take clients from this. So I'm hopefully he'll be representing me. There's court dates coming up for a lot of people. We don't know exactly where we're going to go from this. This only happened 4 days ago, really, and people are still coming to grips with it, with exactly what happened. I mean, we had a large meeting last night, and absolutely nothing was achieved. Four people of the key organizers broke down in tears. So it's really quite an emotional time for people. Nobody expected this to happen here in Halifax. Nobody was emotionally prepared for it. So I think before anything too major of an inquiry or of another protest happens, people need to just get their feet back on the ground and heal a little bit. And that's what we're really trying to do. But in the longer term, yes, there will hopefully be an inquiry, and yes, there will be solidarity actions with the G8 protests in Ottawa and Kananaskis.
And Sarah, if people want to get in touch with the mobilization in Peterborough, could you give them some information for that?
Sure. You can, I'm trying to think of, you can either, we've got some information posted on the Ontario Indie Media site, so there should be stuff posted there. You can also phone OPIRG. The number is 705-748-1767, or you could send an email to OPIRG. It's just OPIRG, O-P-I-R-G, at trentu.ca. And then I can forward information to people that way.
And Chris, if folks wanted to get in touch with the mobilization in Halifax, where do they go?
You can email hfx-g7@ziplip.com or call 494-6662.
And the area code?
902.
So it's 902?
902-494-6662.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us for this series that we're pulling together, the G7, G8 meetings that are upcoming in Kananaskis are taking place on June 26th and 27th, and I think it's very valuable to have this discussion about the community actions that are happening across Canada in response to this summit in Kananaskis. It's a retreat of sorts. Originally, the meeting had been planned for in Ottawa, and since then, it's been moved to Kananaskis, a sort of response to the massive protest in the streets of Quebec City last April of 2001. Chris and Sarah, I want to thank you both for joining us today, just ask you if you have anything else to add?
Thank you very much. La lucha sigue.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I'm really looking forward to hearing the rest of the other communities and the rest of the radio show.